This is Cecil Prescott. This is KBOO FM, Portland. We're speaking today with Thomas Chatterton Williams, author of Losing My Cool, How a Father's Love and 15,000 Books Beat Hip-Hop Culture. Welcome to the Pacific Northwest.
Thank you for having me.
It's great that you are here, and it's a wonderful opportunity to have a conversation with you about your book and about your personal journey.
Sure.
Perhaps we can begin by sharing with our listeners a little bit about yourself in terms of your history.
Sure. I grew up in New Jersey. I was born in 1981 to a black father from Texas, the segregated South when he was growing up, and a white mother from California who met in California working in the poverty programs, the Great Society programs under Lyndon Johnson, and made their way gradually up to Spokane, where my father, Spokane, Washington, where my father worked for some black studies programs, helped found some early black studies programs after studying at the University of Oregon. And then they gradually made their way east, and my father worked in anti-poverty programs in Newark, New Jersey, which is where I was born, and then I grew up. After the money kind of ran out, we moved to the suburbs where my father started an SAT preparation business out of the home, and that's the environment I grew up in, this small suburban home filled with books and a lot of love and a lot of instruction about what it was to be black in the country. That's the broad outline mm-hmm. of it.
Well, you mentioned what it meant to be black in this country, and you make a point in your book to say that you grew up black, and in terms that wasn't necessary you have any conflict or angst around that. But in this day and age when we talk about multiracial families, mm-hmm. Were there other multiracial families that you grew up around?
No, there weren't. And, you know, that's a point in the book that I try to make clear. I my brother and I grew up black, understanding that we were black and not, we didn't grow up thinking we were mixed or biracial, and I had never met anyone else who claimed to be biracial until I got to college, actually. I grew up in a town that was informally segregated, so there was a black side of town and a white side of town. And my father, coming from Texas, he was born in 1937, and he lived his whole childhood and adolescence on the black side of town formally. Coming to New Jersey, when real estate agents tried to steer our family to the black side of town, my father, out of principle, said no and demanded that he could be shown all listings. So as a principled stance, we lived on the white side of town, and there was initially one other black family, and then there was a third black family. Mm-hmm. And my father and my mother both, before they had children, both agreed that their children were black. And that's most likely how we would be viewed by whites and other blacks and treated. So not only should we just accept it, but we should be proud of that. And so my brother and I grew up, you know, confused about many things, but who we were and that we were black and proud was not something we were confused about.
And in terms of your development, you were born in 1981, and that was the beginning of, well, some of us like to say the golden era of around hip-hop, mm-hmm. and beginning in the 80s. So you grew up as a hip-hop child and listening to the music and
mm-hmm.
all?
So, I did. My brother was born in 1976, so he really grew up in that golden era you mentioned. He kind of came of age in the 80s, and I was born in 81, and the 5-year difference meant that I really came of age in the 90s, which in the hip hop era, which is in its mid 30s, some people would put it closer to age 40 if you really go back. That means that it had already been in its second or even third iteration. And by the time I was really aware of it and influenced by it, I was in what some other people call a golden era, which is the mid 90s of the Notorious B.I.G. and Tupac, and then later Jay-Z and Nas. But that was a golden era in terms of the rhymes and the music, in my mind. But in terms of the culture, something had happened, and it had become markedly harder. Mm-hmm. And you know, some people say that was due to the West Coast influence that came with N.W.A. and Dr. Dre and kind of the L.A. gang culture that became glamorized in music videos. But whatever the reason, by the time I kind of really became 12, 13, 14 years old, 15, the golden age of kind of just party music had given way to something a bit harder and a lot more popular and a lot more powerful.
We're speaking with Thomas Chatterton Williams, author of Losing My Cool, How a Father's Love and 15,000 Books Beat Hip-Hop Culture. Speaking about hip-hop culture and your father's love of books, your father had an enormous library.
He did, yes, which he which coming from west to east, he shipped. And I hear stories about, you know, filled up a huge truck and, you know, movers were pretty astounded when they picked up the boxes. I said, what do you have in here? You know, metal or something? It's like, no, this is my library. And we didn't have many things growing up, but what we did have in abundance were books. And I write about it in my book. You know, at times the books were overwhelming in the house. We lived in a one-story ranch house. And at times when my father was moving things, there were books not just in every room, but even in the bathroom. Temporarily, there were books stacked in the bathtub. I mean, they were literally everywhere you turned.
And your father, who you call Pappy, is that the name? Pappy.
Mm-hmm.
Was probably because of his background, thought education was very important and that one needs to have a proper attitude and approach to the world. As you were growing up, I think all children sort of like look at their parents kind of wearily and say, mm-hmm. I'm not sure who they are. They're really stupid. And your attraction towards hip-hop music and culture, was that just something natural? It wasn't open rebellion against your father?
Right. It was not a rebellion or a decision so much as it was, I was fitting into the milieu that I had been born into. So in my house, I had one image of a black man who was reading and who was carefully groomed and who spoke with a certain type of vocabulary. But that was one man. And then when I turned on the TV, I turned it on to black entertainment television, and I saw another image of what blackness might be. And I played basketball. That was what, you know, what we all did. We played a lot of basketball, and that type of blackness on the basketball court, it looked much more like what I saw in black entertainment television than what I saw in my house. And then when I got my hair cut, couldn't get my hair cut on the white side of town, we went to the neighboring black neighborhood, Plainfield, New Jersey, which is a bigger town, is technically a small city. And that image I saw of blackness corresponded again with what I saw on black entertainment television. And so part of being proud of being black meant that I was also, you know, fitting into the culture that was around me and claiming it as my own. And so that culture at times veered wildly apart from the culture of my house. But mm-hmm. I wasn't rebelling with the culture of my house. I was simply fitting in with my social circle.
And as a young adolescent and fitting in within your social circle, there was a natural attraction towards a certain lifestyle and mm-hmm. music and culture. While reading your book, I was reminded of a video, it probably is before your time, Michael Jackson Bad video, mm-hmm. where he's in this prep school and he comes back to the neighborhood and there's that struggle about mm-hmm. who is he in terms of identity. And so I thought of that when I read your book, and it started me thinking about other books which address the issues of the struggle of black person in America. Who am I? Where do I stand? And what society do I place my feet in? In your book, as you talk about this first love for hip-hop, then this distancing from hip-hop, could you explain maybe a definition of hip-hop,
because I think... Sure. Okay, yeah, it's good to do, because the more that I talk about the subject, the more that I realize it's important to distinguish between hip-hop music, rap music, which is, in my mind, only one aspect of it, and hip-hop culture, which is kind of a lifestyle. It's, by many people, it's almost a secular religion. It's a way of dressing, it's a way of talking, it's a body language, it's a certain set of ideas that are in your head as well as a certain set of ideas that are not in your head. So I make the argument that in the past 30 or 40 years of the hip-hop era, which is essentially also the post-civil rights era, that through the vehicle of hip-hop culture, which rap music and hip-hop music provides a soundtrack to, black culture, which is something much larger than merely hip-hop or jazz or any kind of genre of music, black culture in the popular imagination, as well as in the black imagination, has been narrowed over the decades into something that looks a lot like merely black street culture. And so for me, hip-hop culture in many ways is synonymous with black street culture. It's an art form which some older black critics dismiss as something less than music or something inferior to jazz, which is not an argument that I make. I don't think that the music is an inferior art form or music form, but I do think that the culture promotes and glorifies and is based in, the fact is it's based in street culture. It comes from the South Bronx, and that's fine, but it is only one black experience. And the problem is when one black experience pushes out all other black experiences and narrows the concept of black identity to only one or a couple of ways of being black, where we get to a point where black youth have lost touch oftentimes with other forms of being black. So my friends and I write about, did not really understand jazz or know, we couldn't have distinguished a Miles Davis track from one by John Coltrane. Mm-hmm. And we were also ignorant of black writers. I don't think that many of my classmates had ever read the autobiography of Malcolm X, for instance, which is kind of a very important text in the history of black identity, or none of us had really known who James Baldwin or Ralph Ellison were, let alone Richard Wright, W.E.B. Du Bois. Many of us had never read Frederick Douglass. But we all could recite all of the lyrics to All Eyes on Me or Ready to Die or Life After Death. We all were really following anything that Jay-Z did, any move that he made, any clothing style that he adopted. That to us was what really being black was, and we saw ourselves in Jay-Z. But many of us didn't know who James Baldwin was, or even if we had seen him, we certainly wouldn't have seen ourselves in him.
We're speaking with Thomas Chatterton Williams, author of Losing My Cool. My name is Cecil Prescott. This is KBOO-FM. Speaking of hip-hop as one small part of black culture, mm-hmm. maybe one small part of black street culture, mm-hmm. there was a time I mentioned in terms of hip-hop going through different phases. Mm-hmm. And there was a time, say, late 80s, early 90s, when in terms of the music itself, there was some exploration of Afrocentric themes. Mm-hmm. Guru started doing stuff with jazz. And then,
yeah, which never really caught on. Yeah. The jazzmatazz stuff that he was doing was definitely taking the music in a different direction.
So why do you think those things did not catch on, and rather other portions mm-hmm. of the culture caught on?
Well, clearly it's the money. The money has been made for before hip-hop for centuries in America with a certain kind of limited view of blackness. So you had black minstrels in the past, and you have always had black entertainers and prize fighters and athletes. And perhaps on a certain level, that's what non-blacks want to see. And certainly we know it's long been commented on the fact that most hip-hop albums are sold to white kids, or to non-blacks at least. So there is a certain image of blackness that has proven in the marketplace to be very profitable. And it wasn't the blackness that was Afrocentric or overtly political, though groups like Public Enemy in the time period that you reference were certainly on MTV and certainly made a living. But what we know is that gangster rap, which started coming out of Los Angeles, really blew the genre up into a hugely powerful industry. And then, you know, you have variations of gangster rap, which, you know, were replicated on the East Coast. And then what I think is the most lamentable term in the history of hip hop is when the South really started to dominate the aesthetic, and you had something that lost a lot of the lyrical complexity and a lot of the varied experience and started to push cocaine rap and kind of like a party music that had none of the joy or oftentimes did not have the joy of the party music that was coming out of the South Bronx in the 80s and 70s, but a party music that really kind of pushed a pimp culture and a pimp and hoe, I guess, kind of discourse. Mm-hmm. And in the past decade, you know, the dominant acts have all fit into that mold. They haven't been the eccentric types. It's been, you know, 50 Cent, maybe he's the 50 Cent Jay-Z who raps about drug dealing. I mean, that's one very popular form of the East Coast rap. And then, you know, when I think of the South, I think of two big movements. First, No Limit Records with Master P, which was pretty hard, and represented, you know, the New Orleans sound that really caught on, and then the Cash Money Records sound that has most recently made a superstar out of Lil Wayne, and he's kind of gone more mainstream. But the aesthetic that they represent is, to me, it's the dominant aesthetic of hip hop now. I look on, you know, TV and the radio, and you see artists like Gucci Mane and OJ the Juice Man, and these guys, they sell an image of blackness that is rooted in, I think, some very old stereotypes, which is blacks are physical, they're violent, they're criminal, unthinking, and that they're sex-driven. So that's a lamentable turn. It didn't, hip-hop may not have started that way, but it started certainly in a way that made that a possible outcome, mm-hmm. and then corporate interests certainly saw that and have helped promote it.
Let's talk a little bit in terms of your own personal evolution. As a child who was enamored by hip-hop music and culture, and also there was a gradual awakening, if mm-hmm. I could say, in terms mm-hmm. of your own development. What were some important points in your evolution?
Well, the thing is that no matter what I did outside of the house, I always had to spend a lot of time studying with my father. One of the things was, since he was working from the home, and he was working teaching other children academic subjects and preparing them for the SATs and AP exams, one of the things was that he was home, and so he was going to do the same thing with his own children. So my brother and I studied with my father for hours every day, after school, on weekends, and in the summertime we studied full-time with him as though school had never stopped. So my father gave my brother and me the foundation to be thoughtful. Even when I was rejecting it on another level, when I was outside the house, I was still reading books. I was still accountable to my father, and in ways that I didn't realize it was taking root. I studied with my father for the SAT for years, and when the test came around, I did well enough that it was surprising to me. I had played basketball, and I had always thought of going to college to play basketball, but at a certain point in my junior or senior year, it became clear to me that I could go to college on an academic scholarship, and I ended up going to Georgetown on an academic scholarship. And when I got to Georgetown, I started to see a wider universe that I hadn't seen in the neighborhood in New Jersey that I grew up in, and I realized that many of the things my father had been telling me were being reinforced and reflected in this wider world, and I realized that I liked a lot of it, and that some of the tools that he had given me that I had hid in high school around my peers were now some of the same things that would help me prosper in this new world that I found myself in. So I started studying subjects that I hadn't paid much attention to, that I thought were simply things my father made me do, but I started reading philosophy, and I started taking philosophy classes, and I realized that the questions about how does one create a life of meaning, how does one deal with ethical questions, how does one try to be an individual when all around there's pressure to conform, these ideas became questions that I found myself drawn to. And as I started to answer these questions, I started to think more and more critically on the way that I had grown up.
As you began to think critically on the way you grew up and begin to challenge some of those settled ideas, you've written about that in terms of your critique of, mm-hmm. of hip-hop culture. Any negative feedback in terms of your writing?
I've had negative feedback. I've also, you know, to be fair, I've been surprised at the positive feedback that I've gotten, sometimes from where it comes. Mm. I've received some passionate negative feedback from whites, which surprised me at first, but it doesn't surprise me so much anymore. This argument I started in 2007 when I was in graduate school at NYU, and I wrote an op-ed that ended up running in the Washington Post, which basically made the argument that we've just spoken about, that in the hip-hop era, black culture has been confused with black street culture. And I got that article generated a lot of comments and was reposted on blogs. And one of the things that I kept seeing that surprised me back then was that a lot of young whites who were on the left and who were considering themselves championing black people were saying that I was out of touch with black reality, mm-hmm. and were branding me some type of either self-hating black or black elitist. And what they were doing, in effect, it struck me, was they were in defending poor blacks against some elitist black kid from Georgetown, they were actually excusing some ideas and values that end up, in the long term, in my view, hurting the very people they say they're defending. And then I was surprised to get some very passionate defenses. I would read the comments, and sometimes someone would say, you know, I'm only 20 years old, but I grew up in the ghetto in Baltimore, and I have to admit that some of what Williams is saying, maybe I don't agree with all of it, but some of what he's saying is absolutely true, and I'm pretty in touch with black reality, and I can say mm-hmm. that sometimes I don't like what I see either. And then I got what I expected was, you know, older blacks, blacks of my father's generation, but younger than that, but black parents, and oftentimes middle-class blacks were writing comments and letters to say, thank you for, you know, someone younger saying this because I've felt this too. And, you know, and then I got some support from white conservatives, which I also, it didn't surprise me. I don't consider myself a black conservative, but I'm making some arguments that conservatives naturally would agree with, which is that a lot of problems in black life are cultural and not socioeconomic. I would never say that there are no socioeconomic discrepancies and problems that need to be addressed. But I also think that when there's a problem and some of it is cultural, we have to speak frankly about where the problems are and not only focus on socioeconomic problems and ignore cultural explanations, because if your goal is to solve problems, you need to look comprehensively at them.
I think one of the things that your book helped provoke is this conversation among many different people. Mm-hmm. And a couple of things I noticed. One was the importance of your family and your father.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, the importance of to challenge the norm. When so often you hear the phrase keeping it real,
mm-hmm.
that there needs to be another voice to challenge that phrase and maybe even challenge what it means to be real. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what you do in this book.
Well, that's the goal of the book, is to challenge what do we mean when we say keep it real, and are there not other real ways to be black? And for that matter, you know, in the book, I think that maybe, you know, I'm speaking specifically about black life, but this applies to all life. You know, what do we mean when we say someone's authentic as opposed to inauthentic? And are you penalized for not fitting into a certain mold of a culture that you were born into? And, you know, that's a universal struggle that people go through.
And when you said that, I said, let's talk about existentialism. You know?
Sure.
Just in terms of, you know, what does it mean to be human,
mm-hmm.
and those type of questions. Where do you see hip-hop evolving? Can it be saved?
It's interesting. I think that we live in an interesting time, clearly. As I was writing this book, we had our first black president elected. And when I started writing the book, it didn't look at all likely that that would happen. But he's been in office for over a year now. And I think that has done a lot to change. The music and the culture maybe haven't changed immediately, but the ideas circulating in black America certainly have expanded. And I have to believe that 5, 10, 20 years down the line, the fact that Barack Obama has just in the most visible way shown a different type of blackness, and his wife has shown a different type of blackness, and one that is proudly black, but also, you know, and he even had an out. He could have said he's not really black, mm-hmm. but he purposefully defined himself as black. And I think that in doing so, he didn't strike the young brothers and sisters as inauthentic. He struck them as authentic, but also he's speaking in a way that clearly has ramifications, and he's showing a way of being black in the world that is broader than what we've seen in the hip hop culture that has obtained in the past 3 decades. So I think that perhaps the music and the culture will grow and survive by being broad enough to hold all this together. But it's my personal wish that that a new culture may emerge, a wholly new movement in culture, you know?
Wow. And it will. I mean, one thing I think about black culture is that it's constantly evolving.
It has, yeah.
And the fact that there have been times when we've looked and said, well, gosh, how will they ever survive?
Mm-hmm.
And somehow people do. And, you know, mentioning even in terms of cultural expressions, in terms of music, mentioned jazz and,
mm-hmm.
you know, all the challenges that genre faced in terms of acceptability, mm-hmm. and what is good and what mm-hmm. is not good. So you can remain optimistic about what shall be.
Well, yeah, if history is our guide, you know, hip-hop is already a very old culture and musical form.
Yeah. 40 years. Mm-hmm. We were speaking with Thomas Chatterton Williams, and we didn't even speak about how you got your name in terms of your father, your parents being very aware of their children and what type of example they wanted to set.
Yeah. Well, I'm named after a British poet, Thomas Chatterton, who killed himself at the age of 17. He was distraught because it's still not 100% clear, but it seems that he was a child prodigy and he was writing poetry that, for some reason or another, people eventually accused him of having plagiarized. Mm-hmm. And so he was very poor and penniless and distraught. He drank some poison and killed himself. And then after his death, it seemed that people said, oh, you know, maybe he did write that. Oops. And my father, I guess, when he was a young man, came across this story. And it just broke his heart. And so he decided that when he had children, he would name one of his children after this poet. And that in some way or another, we would pay respect to this life that was never honored when Thomas Chatterton was alive. And so since I was a young child, my father told me, you know, you wear the name of a brilliant poet and you too, you can be a writer if you want to be. And so I didn't set out to be a writer or necessarily think I would be, but that was always something that was said, and so it didn't seem strange either. And so I guess subliminal suggestions or just repeated suggestions, they do take hold. And so when I was 17, I remember thinking, well, you know, when I turned 18, I outlived Thomas
you
Chatterton.
Made it.
I made it.
Well, certainly you have fulfilled, I think, the legacy of Thomas Chatterton and Mr. Williams, and we really thank you for joining us today. We've been speaking with Thomas Chatterton Williams, author of Losing My Cool, How a Father Love and 15,000 Books Beat Hip-Hop Culture. Thank you for joining us today, and we look forward to reading more from you in the future.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.